You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If literature is any guide, aging is a process that's been baffling human beings since we began asking ourselves about the meaning of life. In her latest novel, Linda Grant explores what growing up and growing older has been like for the baby boomer generation through the life of a man named Stephen Newman. We Had It So Good is published by Scribner, and I'm pleased to welcome Linda Grant to our show today. Hello.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Although Stephen Newman ends up spending much of his life in the UK, he was born in California. How does he become interested in science?
Well, I think he's just kind of good at science. You know, he's in his mother's kitchen, and he kind of watches his mother baking and seeing the kind of alchemical qualities of what you can do with flour and chocolate. And his father gives him a science kit, a chemistry kit, and he becomes a scientist because he believes in the future and progress and scientific achievement.
Well, he is not, he's not really a hero in this book.
No, but, you know, I don't know how many heroes there are in real life, you know. He's a regular flawed human being who is, you know, most of the time a good family man and a good provider, and has somehow, by a trick of fate, found himself spending most of his life on the wrong side of the Atlantic. You know, he's, as he says, you know, he's the only wetback who, you know, who entered Britain from America rather than the other way around.
He's the son of immigrants, and immigrants have been important characters in many of your other novels.
Yeah.
Didn't you write about your own family's immigrant experience in the book Remind Me Who I Am Again?
Yeah, that's right. But both my both maternal and paternal grandparents were Jewish immigrants who were on their way to New York. And there was a very customary thing which happened to a few poor people, which is that they bought tickets to New York, but the ticket actually didn't go that far. So they wound up sort of dumped, you know, sort of they're on the wrong side of the Atlantic. And so, yeah, I mean, I grew up in a, you know, Orthodox Jewish family in Liverpool, kind of constantly dreaming of the new world.
But
and being, trying to be
but
an
you
immigrant.
Stayed. You could have moved here. I mean, there are British writers who have come.
Martin
Amis is about to move to Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know he is. Well, my father actually spent 10 years in America as a young man, and my sister spent 10 years living in Washington. But we always seem to kind of, we get over here and then we somehow seem to come back to Europe. I don't know why it keeps happening.
And the immigrant experience continues to intrigue you as a topic. Is that because it's about the challenge of finding one's way in a new place?
No, I think it is. Philip Roth said a very clever thing in one of his novels. He was talking about the Jews and the Irish and the Italians having played their part in the building of the national identity in America. And in Britain, when my grandparents arrived, the national identity had been formed centuries earlier. So I always felt myself to be an outsider, you know, and I always felt this sort of, you know, sense of, you know, being on the outside looking in. And that has changed, I think, quite a lot in the past 40 years because of immigration from the Caribbean and from Africa.
The Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth. But then what happened was then the Jews were classified as white people. So, you know, I felt even more kind of alienated from the multiculturalism than ever.
Well, so Britain now sees itself as a country with a lot of immigrants?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But has resisted quite a, if Americans have had problems in working out their response to immigrants, the British even more so. I remember
when
I was there.
Far more so, yeah. And in fact, you know, I mean, the major kind of, you know, political issue at the moment is immigration with, you know, a lot of people saying, you know, we don't, and the immigration's coming from Eastern Europe. People, you know, we don't want these people coming over here taking our jobs. So we're not a continent of immigration.
What about someone like Stephen, who's coming from the United States?
Well, Stephen comes over to Britain as a Rhodes Scholar in 1968, really with only the intention of staying for 2 or 3 years to do his doctorate. And as a flower child, he unfortunately starts manufacturing LSD in the science labs.
He came over the same time that Bill Clinton
He comes over on the same boat as
but
Bill Clinton.
They don't have the same experience.
They do not. And in fact, Stephen, you know, is deeply upset when sort of, you know, 20 or 30 years later, he realizes he's just, you know, a kind of a BBC producer And, you know, his shipmate is now president of the United States. So he cannot help comparing, you know, his experience as part of his life's disappointments.
Well, there probably were a lot of people on that ship, and only one of them became the president of the United States.
Exactly, yeah.
And then he meets Andrea.
Yeah, so what happens is he gets sent down for manufacturing LSD. He has this, and then the draft
kicks in.
Was
LSD really popular in England?
Oh, yes, it was, yeah. I could tell you stories, yeah.
This was during the...
Yeah, 60s, late 60s, early 70s. There was a lot of LSD at Oxford. I didn't go to Oxford, but I know. And so he doesn't want to go back to America and be drafted, so he marries his girlfriend, and it is not a love match. There's nothing romantic about it. She marries him to save him from the draft, and then 40 years later, they are still married, and they're still together, and they have children, and he's still living in London. And everything that he's tried to accomplish has somehow not quite worked out.
Well, he and Andrea are not as intrigued by the philosophies and the radical politics of their friends.
Well, you know, what I wanted to write about in this novel was not so much the radical politics, but ideas which, you know, if you talk to, you know, our children's generation, they kind of really don't know what you're talking about. The age of Aquarius, the counterculture. And there's a sort of bit in this novel where they're talking about Wilhelm Reich and the orgone boxes, which I don't think anybody knows about anymore. So they believe in a whole set of kind of hokey, you know, 60s countercultural ideas.
You'd think that was kind of an innocent time?
You know, the one thing you could say about our generation is we were not cynical. I think we were very innocent and we believed in authenticity. And I think there was a lot of innocence, and I think there was no cynicism about, you know, some of the more kind of stupid of these ideas. You remember Carlos Castaneda's, you know, if you took acid, you could fly, you know. I remember hearing all that stuff.
Then Stephen and Andrea moved to London.
Yeah.
And they're a little intimidated by it.
Yeah, you know, it's the big city. Neither of them have experienced the big city before. But they do something which I think was quite common. Well, first of all, they live in a commune, an urban commune.
A squat.
A squat, yeah, in Hampstead. And that was a real house. You know, I mean, I don't know who lived there, but it's now worth about £3.5 million. It's in Hampstead. I passed it actually the day of the royal wedding and was pointing it out to a friend. I said, that used to be a squat. Did you know that? What?
Well, gentrification has raised prices all over.
That's right. So they move into an area, Islington, which very much like sort of Park Slope in Brooklyn, and they move into a room and they wind up owning the house. And so by the sort of, you know, 2008, they're just surrounded by bankers. You know? And the only reason they can live there is because they moved there so early.
At one point, Stephen travels with his family to California.
Yeah.
Is he happy to go home?
Well, he really believes that he can go back home, that he can go back home and he can pick everything up and start all over again. And, you know, he'd been doing a doctorate in chemistry in Oxford. He goes back to California. He thinks, this is it. You know, now I'm home again. And his old professor says, you know, you've been out of research for 10 years. You know, what do you think? Do you think I'm going to give you, you know, a job on my research team? And this is the sort of crushing realization of adulthood that, you know, your dreams are not going to work out. And, you know, he has a lot of difficulty with this.
They also have to deal with their what they think America is like as opposed to what America's really like.
Yeah. I first went to America in 1975 when I graduated from university, and I hitchhiked across America from coast to coast. And I wanted to sort of partly show it through the eyes of his wife, you know, seeing these kind of wondrous things for the first time.
So you change point of view throughout the
book. Yeah, that's right. And partly Stephen looking around and seeing what actually I saw, which was, you know, a lot of hippies, you know, long-haired guys in wheelchairs or with amputated limbs or whatever, and you realize these were Vietnam veterans. And, you know, he suddenly realizes that they're, but for the grace of God, that the grace of his wife agreeing to marry him. you know, he would have gone to Vietnam.
But America's also a fantasy for people who have never been here, although she's been married to an American.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I wanted to show in the novel is when she meets his parents, you know, and she comes from this sort of very middle-class English stock. For the first time she meets his parents, his father, both of them are immigrants, his father's Jewish, his mother comes from Cuba, and she has a sort of, you know, a little feeling of anti-Semitism as she sees his father for the first time. She's married to this guy who's Jewish, she doesn't think he's Jewish or didn't think of him as Jewish, and she suddenly realizes that she's in an environment that she does not understand at all. She's completely out of her depth.
Although she could have found something similar in London if she knew where to look.
Yeah, quite.
They have two kids, Marianne and Max. And at a certain point, you get the impression that Andrea and Stephen may not be the best parents because they don't notice that Max is seriously losing his hearing.
Yes, that's right. You know, I mean, people have said to me, are they not good parents? But, you know, everything in the book about their children is about them worrying. You know, they're always worrying about their parents, but maybe missing the bigger picture or missing the signals. So, yeah, their son, you know, just gradually loses his hearing, and they have not noticed this, although his older sister has noticed it. But I think, you know, they're parents who just desperately want the best for their children.
The baby boomer generation was known for making its break with the past and their parents' generation. But Max and Marianne seem to have a lot of trouble understanding their parents, Stephen and Andrea.
Yeah.
Is that just the nature of the relationship between parents and their children?
Yeah, I think it is.
Or do you think things have changed a bit since the end of World War II?
Well, I mean, I think there was probably a bigger gulf between us and our parents, because I think our parents never talked about things. They didn't talk about everything, anything. One of the things I wanted to say in this book is about how we thought we were so special and we thought we were going to change the world and we were going to make the revolution. It wasn't really until my 40s until I realized actually our parents were a lot more interesting than we were. You know, they fought the Second World War on our behalf. Thank you. I didn't thank them at the time. And Max and Marianne sit there, you know, they just don't believe that their kind of complacent bourgeois parents living in their expensive house in Islington really used to live in a squat, you know, and had long hair and, you know, manufactured LSD. They just don't believe it, because I think there's always that gulf between the generations.
At one point, Marianne says to Max about their parents, "You cannot rely on them for the truth. Parents, by definition, are liars." But parents have to lie to their kids. You can't say to your kid, you know, "I was stoned all the time when I was." That's almost like saying, "I'm encouraging you to become a drug abuser."
I think that's absolutely right. I think that, you know, that we all edit our past for our children's consumption, and we sort of tell them the things that we want them to hear, and we suppress the things that, you know, we don't want them to know about.
This is also about how the baby boomers have had a hard time adjusting to the fact that they get older.
Yeah.
Stephen is kind of shocked when he realizes he's going to be 50. Do you think many of us don't realize that we're aging until one day we notice that our hair has changed color or there are bags under our eyes that weren't there when we were younger, the creases in our cheeks a little deeper?
When I was a teenager, I really believed that we were the people who were born young and we were going to stay young forever, and that my parents had made a lifestyle choice to have grey hair and wrinkles and pot bellies, but we would obviously be deciding on something different. And I think the kind of terrible shock of realization that we were not immune from aging has been very traumatic.
Well, we talked earlier about how you switch points of view so that we can get the perspectives of the different characters, but that's also because they don't necessarily have a real perspective on themselves.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Somebody, you know, a literary editor said to me that, you know, that one of the kind of tragedies of the book is, you know, how we try to suppress the knowledge of our own failings. You know, Stephen is deliberately not a particularly introspective character. He is somebody who's, you know, constantly looking forward to the brave new world, you know, to the future, and gradually getting more and more depressed by, you know, what that actually means. I think that their, you know, their self-realizations comes rather late. But there is one character in the book who does stay true to the revolution, and she is the most damaged of all. Character of Grace, their friend, who doesn't like Stephen, thinks he's a bourgeois sellout, who is anti-American from the word go. So, you know, immediately the fact, you know, she's berating him about Vietnam in the first moment that they meet. And she goes to Cuba as soon as she graduates from Oxford, and she never really finds her own life.
Americans did have that problem in England. They would show up and British people would start accusing them of pretty much being responsible for all the problems of the world, as though they had spent a time in the White House mm-hmm. themselves when they were usually students or
yes.
often agreed politically with the person who was complaining. You're also a journalist?
Yeah, less and less these days. Yeah.
Won the Orange Prize for fiction in 2000 and the Lettres Ulysses Prize for the Arts of Reportage in 2006. Also shortlisted for the Man Booker. So is that because the immigrant experience is of particular interest to people in England, or is it just that you're a good writer?
Well, obviously, I would like to think it was the latter.
Linda Grant, her latest book, We Had It So Good, published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next on Please Explain, Amy Stewart, the author of Wicked Bugs, joins us for a look at the creepy, crawly insects that we live with. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 646-829-3985 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org.